B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who will put snow tires on a golf cart, Charlie Nance.
Hey there, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT _ golf guy. This week, 10 predictive questions for the upcoming golf season with two of my favorite people, Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, and John McGinnis with Sirius XM and PGA Tour Radio. And in my never-ending effort to help with holiday gift ideas, one of the best golf books in recent memory, Harvey Pinnick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf. We will revisit our chat with author Kevin Robbins. However, we begin today with Ron Green Jr. Last year, this was question number one. Over under major appearances by Tiger Woods, and the number was set at 1.5. This year, I'm going to alter it somewhat. Over under just regular tournament wins by Tiger Woods, and again, I'm going to set the number at 1.5.
Over.
So you think he will win two or more times this next year?
I do think so. I think we're just about to see. I don't think we've seen the best of the new Tiger yet.
I'm of the opinion of that as well, and I'm also of the opinion that when it does happen, it won't last long. Like, we're not in a five-year run here. If we get one and a half, 2 years of it, that will be great, and that'll be the end of it. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I don't. I haven't envisioned it as a five-year thing. I hope we get that, but I think he's the perfect example. Let's take it one tournament at a time, but I'm optimistic we're going to see some really special Tiger this year or next season.
Ron, what is more likely to happen? Rory and or Spieth complete the career Grand Slam this year, or neither ever completes it?
Neither ever completes it.
I think that's the bet. I mean, what, only four or five have done it in all these years of golf?
Yeah. So to narrow it down to this year or this coming year, that's a small window there.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest Taking Dead Aim, our annual 10 predictive questions for the 2019 season. Last year, I asked if Justin Thomas and Brooks Koepka were more likely to build off of their major championship success or have that chasing appearance fees hangover that we see so often. Well, both of them had really good years. Brooks had a great year. Will both, either, or neither win a major this year?
Well, you know there are only four majors.
Yes.
So that narrows it down. I think one of them will win a major. I would skew probably toward Justin Thomas because as good as Brooks Koepka is, and he's number one in the world for a reason. I just think that, you know, he's won three of the last six he's played, I think. And, you know, at some point you can't win them all, although maybe you can win a lot of them. I would love to have either one of chances, but I would give Justin Thomas the edge there.
All right, speaking of major championships, here are your venues this year. Augusta, Bethpage Black, Pebble Beach, and Royal Portrush. Now, do you think with these venues in play, we're more likely to see more players padding their major championship resumes or more likely to see first-time winners?
Padding their resumes. And I say that knowing there's a lot of good players out there. I mean, a guy like Tony Finau or somebody could go win one. It wouldn't surprise anybody. But I just think, you know, a lot of guys have won some. I think when you look at Spieth and Rory and Tiger and Dustin Johnson, those guys, you know, I think we'll have more repeat or you know, multiple major champions now than we'll have first-timers.
If Justin Thomas is to win a major this year, of those four venues, which do you think sets up best for him?
Augusta National. I think Justin Thomas has the game to play Augusta National. I think with, you know, he's emotional, which I like. And, I mean, Jordan Spieth is hugely emotional, too. I think with some seasoning, I think Justin Thomas is primed to win at Augusta.
Ron, as we're recording this, you're working on an article on Cameron Champ for the Global Golf Post. Just won his first tour event, and this guy kills it. However, While averaging 324 off the tee, he was near last in the field in fairways hit, but he was third in greens hit. Now, is this what's wrong with the game, or is this just where the game is and there's nothing that's going to be done about it?
I think it's where the game is. I don't think a whole lot's going to be done about it. I think the PGA Tour views it in some ways as a television show, and that people like to see him hit it long. Now, when you start talking about guys hitting it long, there's long, there's Dustin Johnson long, then there's Cameron Champ long. And he is, Sean Foley says it's like watching a guy run a 4.340 and just thinking, how in the world does somebody do it? And then suddenly a guy blows by him and runs a 4.1. He said that's sort of what Cameron Champ has done in terms of length. But, I mean, he's a guy who, and again, quoting Sean Foley, it's great if you can drive at 360, but if you hit your sandwich 30 feet from the hole, it doesn't do you any good. And I think that's what Cameron Champ understands and the next part of what his evolution will be. But I think there will continue to be a great deal of talk about reining in golf balls and fixing distance and all stuff, but I'll believe it when I see it.
Isn't it a cheaper solution based on what we saw with the Ryder Cup in France? Rather than spending gazillions of dollars rolling back the golf ball and worrying about equipment, how about if we just raise the height of the lawnmower a little bit? And if you grow out the rough, it will keep people from bombing and gouging because they will be unable to do so.
Well, I think that, but I don't want it to be where they build the stick rough right off the fairway and it takes any skill or recovery element out of the game. Phil Mickelson has talked forever that the recovery shot is the most exciting shot in golf. Well, that's probably because Phil can hit more of them than most people. They can be. I mean, I don't think most of the time, if a guy, drives at 325 down there and has a wedge out of the rough, most of the time on the PGA Tour, there's not a lot of drama to it. You know he's going to hit it on the green. How close is he going to hit it? Now, I think if you can find that right equation where, you're penalized for a big miss, you should be penalized a big penalty for a big miss. They hit it so far now that, I don't know how much defense you can play without just making it really, really tricked up. Now, it worked at the Ryder Cup. It's a different kind of golf course, and it's, the penalty was severe. But I don't know if people want to watch that kind of penalty being handed out every week when they're watching on television.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Champ's victory last week does not qualify him for Augusta, but it does qualify him for Kapalua, correct?
Yes.
So we will get to see him hitting down those hills at the Plantation course.
We might be giggling watching.
I was going to say, this could be some must-watch television in January where Cameron Champ goes to Kapalua.
Yeah, it's not hard to hit it 320 off the tee on 17 and 18, those downhill holes out there. I've played it a couple times, and you can move. It just gets going, and there's nothing to stop it. But his goes so far before it lands, it's just, it will be some fun stuff to see.
I mean, I'm envisioning him playing the 18th at Kapalua, and if the winds are right, and if he hits it far enough out to the right, we could be looking at like driver 7 iron, driver 8 iron on a almost 700-yard par 5.
It will be worth keeping an eye on, yeah. I think, that'll be one of the interesting early season things, getting out there and watching him see what he does. Of course, I mean, you go back and arguably the shot of the year, Dustin Johnson hit on, a 430-yard par 4?
Almost hold it, yeah.
Yeah, you can do it out there. Or let me rephrase it. They can do it out there.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Our guest taking Dead Aim, 10 predictive questions for the upcoming golf season. We're up to number 6. Bryson DeChambeau, Ricky Fowler, John Rahm. Those are the only 3 players currently in the top 10 in the world who have not won a major. Who wins one first, and will it be this year? And would your answer change if I threw in number 11 in the mix, Tommy Fleetwood?
No, my answer would not change. Banking on what Butch Harmon says, I think Ricky is the one who wins first. I just think that he did not have a great year, didn't win this year on the PGA Tour, but he plays well a lot. I think you know, I think you could obviously make a case for any of those guys. I mean, John Rahm, obviously, DeChambeau, I mean, he will equation it to death one of these years. And Fleetwood, I mean, Fleetwood, you know, but for Brooks Koepka, Shinnecock would have been differently. But I'm going to take Ricky Fowler. I'm still in his camp in this one.
See, I am too, and especially being a California kid, there's something about him playing at Pebble Beach that I like. I could be completely wrong and just two in the tank for a really nice guy. I don't know. Ron, one of my favorite annual questions here, yes or no, do you think the USGA finds a way to screw up the setup at Pebble and make themselves the story once again?
They've had enough practice at Pebble Beach that I think they're going to grow a lot of rough out there, rely on the June gloom and the fog and everything to soften the golf course to make it play a little longer. I think they get Pebble Beach right.
Question number 8. Billy Payne is going into the World Golf Hall of Fame for his work, essentially his work in growing the game in the last 10 years as chairman at Augusta National. However, unlike the previous chairman, he made no significant changes to the golf course. How much change and how fast do you think they occur with the new chairman, Fred Ridley? And do you think there's any chance of rolling back some of the Hootie changes that were so universally panned?
I think Fred Ridley will have more hands-on influence on the golf course. I think partly because Billy Payne was focused on other things. And obviously, his legacy is tied to the drive, chip, and putt. Expanding all the facilities down there, feeling like he sort of opened the doors to the world to Augusta National with the two big amateur events they created. And I think Fred, being the player he has been through his years, will take a very close look at the golf course. I mean, we'll already see a new fifth hole next year. That's already been done. So that part has been put in play. I think there will be changes. Will they ever take down the forest that was planted along the right side of the 11th hole? I hope they do, but I'm not holding my breath for that. And, you know, I hope they don't change the 13th hole. It may be inevitable, but I just would hate to think they have to go change that hole. But I think, you know, when going all the way back to Bobby Jones and all that, the Augusta National's a golf course. They remain sort of a work in progress. They see it as a living, breathing thing, and they make adjustments, and I'm sure we will continue to see them.
I think I know your answer to this next question based on what I know you're working on right now. Is there a player that you kind of have your eye on, a Cameron Champ, a Sam Burns, an Austin Cook, that you think has a real chance to take that next step this year?
I think you named one of them right there. I think Sam Burns, he had some moments this year. I think he's a really, really good player. And I think he is, Cameron Champ has the explosiveness and the power and he's going to get a lot of people going over to watch him to see how far he hits it. I think Sam Burns might have the pedigree to just be one of those guys who sort of moves right in there and sort of like you're never surprised when you hear his name.
Get you out of here on this. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Our 10 predictive questions for the upcoming golf season. Your surprise or gut prediction about anything in the world of golf this year?
Ooh, that's a big one. I'm finally going to figure it out.
This is the year.
Well, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. You know, a couple swing changes, you know, for a guy who gets to talk to the best teachers in the world and be around the best players in the world, you'd like to think once in a while some of it would rub off. So far, that's not happening.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And up next, author Kevin Robbins takes dead aim at his book that would make a fantastic gift for the golfer in your life this year. Harvey Pienick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf, presented by the Charlotte Office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Kevin Robbins is the author of Harvey Penick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf, and it would make a great gift this holiday season for that golfer in your life. You know, looking at Harvey's life, this could never happen today. From the age of 8, when he became employed as a caddy, he only had one employer until he died in his 90s. That's Austin Country Club. That's insane.
It is. We really don't even have caddies much anymore, and certainly not 8 years old. But in 1912, Austin was still kind of a frontier city, and Austin Country Club was still relatively new, and golf certainly was relatively new to the people in Austin. They didn't know what it was about or how to play it. It was brought to the city by a man, Lewis Hancock, who went to an Ivy League college and met people there who had been to Scotland and talked to him about this fascinating game. And he traveled to the UK and he played it abroad, came back to Austin just like bursting with enthusiasm about this new game in which you hit a ball with a stick into a hole, and they fashioned this crude
which is exactly
layout.
How a Texan would describe it, by the way. Y'all got to see this game. You take this ball and whack it with a stick till it goes in a hole.
Oh, you're going to love this detail. At the first Austin Country Club, where Harvey became a caddy in 1912, they had a hitching post, which was actually a hitching tree, where members could tether their horses to the tree while they went out and played this new game.
That is so fantastic. And then, at age 13, I want you to think about what you were doing at 13. Harvey Penick becomes the assistant head professional, and then was promoted to head professional after he graduated from high school. I mean, so this is lofty responsibility for someone of 13 and 18.
It is, but, you know, they were just kind of figuring things out, and there were no expectations. There was no precedent. There was no peer to follow. They were just sort of bumbling along, doing things as they discovered them, which really was the way that Harvey taught and learned golf his entire life. It was by watching and witnessing. Harvey wasn't an educated man. As you mentioned, he did go to high school. He had to wait until his graduation to become the head professional at the age of 18. But he didn't go to a PGA school. He didn't go away to learn on the range of some East Coast country club with some esteemed professional how to teach golf. He figured it out by watching good results and bad results, and he taught what he saw in the good results, and he did not teach what he saw in the bad results. And so his whole life was just kind of figuring things out through experience.
I remember growing up in Houston, there was a legendary coach at the University of Houston, Dave Williams, won in the teens, I think, national titles at U of H. Dave was not a good golfer. I always found it interesting that he was such a good coach, but not good at the sport that he was coaching. By the time I met Harvey, Harvey was a very old man and had long since given up swinging a golf club. What kind of player was Harvey?
Harvey was a fantastic player, Charlie. He played in what would be the precursor to the PGA Tour circuit in Texas and a little bit beyond. He played with some really notable players in Texas. He qualified for and played in the 1928 U.S. Open at Olympia Fields. And there's a very interesting story that Harvey was reluctant to share because he just didn't talk about himself a whole lot. At that 1928 U.S. Open in Chicago, he played a practice round behind Bobby Jones. And on a particular par three hole, Harvey hit a shot with a spoon, which I think is the equivalent of the three wood now or the three metal. Mm-hmm. He hit the shot up to about 4 feet. I mean, very close. And as he walked up to the green, he saw Bobby Jones lurking off to the side. And Bobby simply said, "Nice shot," to Harvey. And Harvey always remembered that. It's not a story that he told many people. I heard it on a cassette tape of one of the early interviews with Bud Schrake. But that acknowledgement must have been enormous for Harvey because he so looked up to Bobby Jones and to Bobby's teacher, Stuart Maiden, at East Lake Country Club in Atlanta. For the years that Harvey was the head professional at Austin Country Club. He had a poster of Bobby Jones at the finish of his golf swing, and he wanted all of his students to see that Bobby Jones kept his forearms in front of him against his chest at all parts of the swing. That's how much he admired Bobby Jones.
Kevin Robbins is the author of the book Harvey Pienick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Because of Harvey's upbringing and how he went from the caddy yard to being the club professional and learning things in the dirt on the range, it sounds very similar in some respects to two other famous Texans, Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson. I have never seen or read or heard of any sort of relationship, certainly not on a teaching level, but as comrades, as friendship, did he have a relationship with either Hogan or Nelson?
He did, and he was very close with Byron Nelson. I don't know of many people who were authentically close to Ben Hogan, but they did know each other and they did play golf together. In fact, in the spring of 1950, and this would have been after Hogan's accident in West Texas, as he was recuperating and beginning to return to the form that won the 1950 U.S. Open at Oakland Hills, Hogan played an exhibition in Austin at Lyons Municipal Golf Course with Harvey Pienick as his partner. They were playing against two up-and-coming college players. It was an exhibition and benefit for the Lions Club. It was the biggest event of the season in Austin. It even beat out, say, Texas football. People lined up for miles to come watch the great Hogan play their golf course. And they played 18 holes against these two college amateurs. They did lose, but I'm not sure how much Harvey contributed to the effort. But he and Hogan did know each other. They did play together. Late in Hogan's life, when he was retired from professional golf and pretty much just spending his time at Shady Oaks Country Club in Fort Worth, he once told someone from Austin that he had a hitch in his swing, and he said, "Tell Harvey Pienick that I'm going to come see him," but he never did.
Interesting story about Harvey, and I want to get into his teaching method, the simplicity of his teaching method, which is what set Harvey apart. By the time I met Harvey, it was in the early 90s. It was before the Little Red Book came out, and this was after Austin Country Club had moved to its current location. And Harvey, every weekend on Saturday and Sunday mornings, was sort of like the honorary starter. He was there on the first or 10th tee to greet and talk to everybody. One of the guys that I was with told a story with Harvey about the guy's brother. His name was George Rives, and George was on the mini tours. And George played a five-yard draw, and all of a sudden it became a five-yard fade. And it was driving him crazy. And he called Harvey, and he said, just in a panic, and said, "I got to come see you. I got to come see you. I just don't know what to do." And Harvey's blood pressure never got above 40. And he said, "Well, George, come on in." And so George came in, and he said, "George, tell you what, why don't you, go get you a bag and head over to the range, and I'll be there in a few minutes to look at you." So George gets warmed up, and Harvey shows up, and George takes out the driver, and he starts hitting these. And this is with, Balata balls in Persimmon Woods, close to 300-yard drives that were ending up just right of center in the fairway with a little five-yard fade. And he says, "See what I'm talking about? Look at this." He says, "I play a five-yard draw. I can't." And Harvey looked at him and said, "Well, take a couple more swings." Took five more swings, each of them close to 300 yards, five-yard fade. Right center of the fairway. He says, "Harvey, what am I going to do?" He says, "George, I suggest you start aiming 5 yards left." walked off the range. And when they told that story, Harvey remembered it immediately, said, "Absolutely, that happened."
Harvey was a scion of simplicity. And that's why I think he's as relevant today as he was in 1950, 60, and 92 when the Little Red Book came out, because I believe that there's a certain segment of people who play this game, and I identify with this group myself, who find it far too cluttered and complicated and noisy and loud. And I'm not talking about everybody, but I'm talking about some of us. And I think that the simplicity and the clarity and the economy of thought and just the practicality and pragmatism that Harvey brought to the the instruction of this sport is valuable. It's necessary. And that story you just told is exactly that kind of pragmatism. I think that if an instructor is being paid a great sum of money to teach someone, and that gentleman you spoke of came and was concerned about this 5-yard fade, that some instructors would feel compelled to try to figure out how to get him hitting that 5-yard draw again. But Harvey, man, he just saw things so clearly and so practically, and that's how he expressed that message. That's a fantastic story, and it's so, so Harvey Penick.
Kevin Robbins is the author of the book Harvey Penick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf. He's our guest Taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about that little red book,
because that's really when Harvey's name started to become in the forefront of players and teachers alike, the world over, actually. It was the little red book, and the little red book was based on an actual red book that he kept notes on for since the start of his teaching days, wasn't it?
It was hard to figure out exactly, Charlie, when he started keeping those notes. They aren't dated. And the only way that I could really reference when he began writing these notes was the names that he would include and the places that he would include. But let's say, for instance, he started keeping it at about 1950, and that's my best estimate based on when the company that was producing this particular notebook called Scribbletex was in business in Dallas. So, yes, you're right. He started jotting down these notes in this Scribbletex notebook that he kept in a roll-top desk for himself. Now, old son later became a golf professional. Harvey had the mind that he was going to give these notes to his son, but he never had any illusion that this was going to be any sort of book. That all changed in the spring of 1991. Harvey was 86 years old. He was frail. He was diminished. His back had been broken. He had had cancer. And I believe that he was beginning to look retrospectively at his life, and he was taking inventory of everything that he had been privileged to be around and learn golf. And I think he began to feel a little guilty about keeping this notebook just for himself or just for his son. And so he called a mutual friend, a man named Bud Schrake, who had been a writer for Sports Illustrated magazine, kind of a bon vivant, bigger-than-life guy who had lived in New York and dined at Elaine's. And he had Bud out to the country club, and he said, "Bud, do you think we can put this into some sort of publishable form? I think it would be a good instruction book for my fellow PGA professionals." And Bud took a look at it. It's all of 6,600 words. There's no narrative. There's no cohesion to it. It's just a jumble of notes. And Bud, he saw the treasure in this, and he saw the potential, and he said, "Yes, Harvey, I think we can do it." And that became the Little Red Book less than a year later.
Harvey Penick worked, we all know he worked with Tom Kite and Ben Crenshaw since they were boys. He worked with Mickey Wright, Betsy Ross, Kathy Whitworth. Yet, until the Little Red Book came out, Harvey's name was never mentioned in the same sentence like you have today with the Ledbetters and the Harmons and the Haneys of the world. I already know the answer to this question before I ask, but was he resentful in any way that his teachings weren't as highly regarded as these other people?
Oh, I don't think so, Charlie. First of all, it's not the kind of person he was. And Harvey always identified as a caddy first, and that was just how he saw himself, a humble, gracious, thankful steward of the game, but never any sort of vanguard leader of golf instruction. And in fact, his teachings are not vanguard. They're not revolutionary. They're very actually primal. So I don't think, but Harvey was never a resentful person at his core anyway. So I don't think he much cared. I think he was actually slightly amused at the idea of the celebrity golf professional, someone who sort of took the stage and demanded the spotlight. I think Harvey privately probably shook his head and thought, you know, what is that all about? So, no, I don't think he was resentful at all.
You know, every year at the Masters, they replay 1995 and Crenshaw's putt and the putting his hands on his head. And the story's always retold about Harvey's death that week and him going home. I've always thought and wondered if Harvey every year was watching this on the Masters, if he would just say, okay, enough already. I didn't make a shot. Crenshaw did all the work. Just it just seemed to me that he would not like getting as much credit as even Crenshaw gives him for that.
It's possible, but at the same time, he and Ben were so close, and he knew how important he was to Ben. I think he'd be grateful for his connection to golf history in that way. But because it was Ben who produced that win, and that Harvey really had no tangible connection to the win, you know, it's interesting to listen to Ben talk about 1995. Even today, I was on the radio with him about 3 months ago, and we were discussing this very thing. And Ben struggles, even 20 years later, to talk about how that happened. He has no idea. I mean, it was a matter of grace. And it's just Ben still can't put a finger on how he was able to do that at the age of 43, a week after Harvey died.
Kevin Robbins is the author of the book, Harvey Pienick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. All the research you did, all the interviews you conducted, all the stuff that you looked at about Harvey Pienick, what surprised you most about this man?
Wow, that's a really great question. And it's one I've considered. And to be honest, there were no surprises. And I'm grateful that there weren't any, because I think we all have this image of who Harvey was and how he lived his life and what he means to golf and what his legacy is and always should be. And I found nothing to shatter that. I think, though, that the most surprising fact about Harvey that I perhaps knew but now have a greater appreciation for is that thing we were talking about earlier, how fine a player he was, that perhaps if he had committed to the other side of professional golf, and that is playing golf, that maybe he would be mentioned in the same sentences as Hogan and Snead and Byron Nelson. But he chose at a very early age to teach golf instead of play it for a living. And that's why we have him as he is now.
The book is Harvey Pienick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf. A great gift idea this year. That's Kevin Robbins. And when we return, Sirius XM and PGA Tour Radio's John McGinnis takes Dead Aim at the upcoming season with 10 predictive questions presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. John McGinnis is a former pro golfer and easily one of the most entertaining golf broadcasters in the business with Sirius XM and PGA Tour Radio. And he joins us now with 10 predictive questions for the upcoming golf season. All right, John, last year this was question number one, over under major appearances by Tiger Woods. And I set the number at 1.5. This year I'm going to modify it somewhat. Over under regular tour wins by Tiger Woods this year, but I'm going to keep the number at 1.5.
I think that's a good number. I think two.
So you'll take the over on that?
I will.
Okay, now, is this a situation like, I remember talking about this particular kind of question about Phil Mickelson a year ago, and a lot of us were in agreement that if Phil was going to win, Phil needed to win early, that he might run out of gas later in the year. Is that the way you feel about Tiger? If he's going to win, he's going to win early?
No, I mean, I think he can win any time. No, what he can't do is win the Tour Championship, because there's not really a tournament at the Tour Championship next year. They're going to do that staggered start, so I can't defend.
Yeah, I still haven't figured all that out, to be honest with you.
Right. I mean, he can win the FedEx Cup, but that doesn't necessarily mean you win that tournament. I like Phil. I mean, I like Tiger anytime. I love where the majors are. I love his prospects.
We'll get to the majors in a minute, because I know that you probably still wake up in a cold sweat thinking about one in particular. Question number two, and I think this is almost a really good Vegas prop bet. More likely to happen, Rory and or Spieth complete the career Grand Slam this year, or neither ever completes it?
Oh, I think at least one of them will.
So you think one of them might complete it this year?
No, I think that's asking a lot, but I do think that one of them will get it at some point in time.
Yeah, I find it interesting that, you know, somebody has a really hot year, wins a couple of majors, or they have a 2-year run, and everybody immediately just starts to assume, hey, they're going to win the career Grand Slam. And I sit there and think, well, there's only 5 people that have done it since the dawn of man in this game, so it's not as easy as we think.
Right. I completely agree. I think it would be incredible if both of them did it, but I do think that at some point in time, I felt like Rory was going to get that fourth leg at some point.
John McGinnis with PGA Tour Radio and Sirius XM is our guest, taking Dead Aim. 10 predictive questions for the upcoming golf season. Last year, I asked if Justin Thomas and Brooks Koepka were more likely to build off of their major championship success or have that, chasing appearance fees hangover that we see so often. Both of them had really good years. Brooks had a great one. Will both, either, or neither win a major this year?
Whew. That's a great question. I think that of the two, Brooks has a better chance. He's defending at Beth Page. I love him at Beth Page for the PGA. I don't love Pebble Beach for him. Nobody knows a whole lot about the British Open venue.
Yeah, Port Rush is kind of a wild card.
But, I mean, Brooks is so good in the majors that when he gets a chance to win, he wins. So if he gives himself a chance to win this year, he probably will.
All right, let's talk about these major championship venues. Augusta National, Bethpage Black, Pebble Beach, and Royal Portrush. Do you think with these venues in play, we're more likely to see guys padding their major championship resumes, or are we more likely to see first-time winners?
Oh, I think padding. I think padding for sure. Pebble Beach is traditionally... I'm trying to think. I think Tom Kite's the only one who won his only major.
Yeah.
Here. Well, I guess Grant McDowell. But I think he's the only one. Otherwise, you're looking at Jack and Tom Watson and Tiger. So, yeah, I think we're padding.
On a side note, do you still wake up in a cold sweat thinking about the tee shot off the 10th hole at Bethpage Black?
Just couldn't get there. I'm looking forward to covering it. Looking forward to being on the ground. I actually have not been back and walked the golf course since 2002. I did the 2009 U.S. Open there when Lucas won, but I didn't actually walk out there to 10.
So fearful of 10 that you couldn't even walk out there to it.
Well, to me, it's just one of the greatest screw-ups in the history of golf.
In the long and storied history of USGA screw-ups.
Yeah, that's one of the bigger ones. I mean, it's like having a par 3 that nobody can reach. We just couldn't get to the fairway. I played with DeMarco on Saturday. He couldn't get there either.
Where did you guys aim? Because I hear this from people say 70% of the field could not take a dead line on the carry. So where were you aiming, like to the path up on the right? Where were you aiming?
Yeah, we were aiming up the walking path.
Wow.
I mean, I parred it on Friday. I shot 69 on Friday. I parred it. Driver, L wedge, 4-iron, and made the putt.
So great. John McGinnis with Sirius XM at PGA Tour Radio is our guest, taking Dead Aim. 10 predictive questions for the upcoming golf season. Cameron Champ is fascinating to me. Recently won his first tour event. Guy kills it off the tee. However, when he won in Mississippi, he averaged 324 off the tee. He was near last in fairways hit, but third in greens hit. John, is this where the game is and we just got to live with it, or is there nothing that can be done?
It's been there since 04. You know, it's the bombing gouge that Vijay Singh won 9 times that year and became the number one player in the world. He realized that he was better with a wedge out of the rough than with a 7-iron from the fairway. That's where we are. It's all about setup. It's all about philosophy. And if they're not going to change the setup and the philosophy, then the game is going to continue to head in that direction. It's a shame. I mean, it is that they've taken so much of the nuance out, but you can't blame Cameron Champ. He's just played what's in front of him.
Is there something that can be learned from watching the Ryder Cup this last year in that, I'm not saying take it back to the heights of Joe Day and the guys at the USGA. I'm not saying that. I don't want the massacre at Wingfoot week in, week out. But what if they just raised the mower height a notch in the rough on the everyday setups on the PGA Tour? Would this make a difference?
It would make a massive difference. Absolutely. At this point, every time somebody loses their card, they're replaced by somebody longer. I don't care who it is.
Yeah.
Every time somebody loses their job, they get replaced by somebody longer than them. And that's why the tour continues to get longer and longer. I don't know what you can do about it. Raise the rough. They'll have to hit it in the fairway. That'd be great. But it's not a secret. We've known that one for a while.
So what is the reticence to do it? Why won't the PGA Tour in their setups adopt a higher mowing height? Why are they holding back on that?
That's a question for them. I really don't know. They like offense. You know, it looks good on TV, and I don't know if you've noticed yet. Well, you and I would like to see a little tougher scoring conditions. The game, the professional game, it's sold out. They've taken it financially to a level that is massive, incredible.
Jake's digged the long ball, and we need to get into it, I guess. John, Bryson DeChambeau, Ricky Fowler, John Rahm. These are the only three players that are currently in the top 10 in the world who have not won a major. Which one wins first? And if I threw in number 11, Tommy Fleetwood, would that change your mind?
No, I'm not as enamored by Tommy Fleetwood as everybody else. I mean, he plays great golf, but a lot of players play great golf, don't play great golf over here in the U.S., and so far he hadn't won over here. I think the sentimental pick is Ricky, but the fact is, of those four, I think Bryson might end up being the best player.
You know, I'm through doubting that guy. I'm through, like, wondering if he's just, you know, a flash in the pan or whatever. In the last 7 months, he's won as many times as Fowler has in his whole career. You got to stand up and start paying attention to that guy.
I agree. I mean, he's so good. I was worried about his putting. Not worried about his putting anymore. So, yeah, I mean, I'm with you on the mad scientist. I think he wins one pretty soon.
John, one of my favorite annual questions here. Yes or no, do you think the USGA finds a way to screw up the setup at Pebble and make themselves the story once again at the U.S. Open?
I think they have Pebble figured out. I think there's a few venues they go to that they can't really screw up the setup. Oakmont, Pebble, Pinehurst. I think that's the list. I think it's all the whole list.
Everything else, it's game on with Mike Davis. John McGinnis with PGA Tour Radio and Sirius XM, our guest taking Dead Aim. 10 predictive questions for the upcoming golf season. Billy Payne is going into the World Golf Hall of Fame primarily for his work in growing the game as 10 years as chairman of Augusta National. However, he made no significant changes to the golf course. Question is, how much change and how fast do you think it's going to occur with Fred Ridley in the chair now? And do you think there's any chance of rolling back some of the hoodie changes that were just universally panned?
I don't know. I'm sure that there was discussion about what Fred Ridley wanted to do. I think we'll find out when the golf course opens this year at 2019. Of course, they don't really tell us anything. And we know they built a new tee on 5.
Right.
But the discussions about 13, you know, moving that great back, all those rumors, I don't know that any of that's come to fruition. And really, I think the biggest contribution to Fred at this point is the fact that they bought the land that they've been trying to buy from Augusta Country Club to create the outer loop on the golf course. I don't know. I love going to the Masters. I love seeing it. Fred hasn't called and invited me to play, so I've still never played Augusta National. And until that happens, you know, I really can't speak with that much eloquence about it.
You know, I guess there may be a point to be made, and I don't know if someone made it a week or so ago, that Augusta National seems to get it more than anything else, that in addition to being a major, in addition to being a golf tournament, the Masters is a soap opera. It's a TV show. And they seem to get that aspect and embrace that aspect in terms of their course setup and whatnot, so that they're not as concerned as, say, the USGA is with what happens to par, as much as, are you going to be glued to the drama?
Yeah, it's really incredible the way it plays out. I mean, there were those few years in there where they made the golf course so firm and fast that it was hard.
Right.
Trevor Immelman, Zach Johnson, and that stretch there when they won, of course, Zach won laying up on all the par fives. They didn't want that to happen again, and they've made sure that it won't, and I love that. I love the way the story unfolds every year, and you know, it one of those rare things in the world that every year lives up to hype.
Absolutely. Is there a player that you have your eye on this year? Like, you know, a Cameron Champ, a Sam Burns, Austin Cook, for example, a player that you think will take that next step this year?
I'm fascinated to see what Bryson does. Obviously, he's already started taking that step. I'm looking forward to watching Patrick Reed this year. He's defending at Augusta, but after all that happened following the Ryder Cup, you know, he's anything but remorseful, isn't he? And so I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out. And as far as the young players go, there's so many good ones that, I mean, obviously we mentioned Cameron Champ, but just a slew of really good young players. So we're gonna learn some names this year that we just never heard of, and we're gonna continue to marvel at kids like Austin Cook and some of these young players that have had good success already on the PGA Tour.
Get you out of here on this. John McGinnis with SiriusXM and PGA Tour Radio. Our guest taking Dead Aim. 10 predictive questions for the upcoming golf season. And number 10, this one's wide open. Your surprise or gut prediction about anything in the world of golf this year?
I think Tiger's player of the year. I think Tiger Woods at 42 or 43 is the PGA Tour player of the year. And that's just astounding to consider, considering where he's been. Other than that, I don't really have too many thoughts in terms of how players will do. I don't think that from a record standpoint it's going to be all that amazing, but I think Tiger wins 2 or 3 times. I think he wins a major.
That's where I was going to go. If Tiger's going to be player of the year, he has to win a major. I assume you like his chances at the first two venues more than any other, or maybe Pebble as well. But of Pebble and Augusta and Bethpage, which do you think at this point in Tiger Woods' career you could see him winning more than the others?
I think Pebble. He did win about 15 shots here at Pebble. Bethpage is I'm curious to see how it gets set up, because we've only seen it for one. It was hard twice. And then we saw it for the Barclays, or the first event in the playoffs, and it wasn't hard at all. So I can't wait to see what the PGA of America does with the setup there. I think the harder the better for Tiger.
One of my favorite guys in golf, hands down, from Sirius XM and PGA Tour Radio, that, of course, the unmistakable John McGinnis. Also like to thank Kevin Robbins, author of Harvey Pienick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf, a great gift idea this season for the golfer in your life. And, of course, my friend Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for his time and insight this week. Hey, reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks just after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Just be sure to like us on Facebook. Search Taking Dead Aim. Currently featured there articles on yet another Tiger Rules snafu, this time at his Hero World Challenge, and a surefire sign you've got golfers in your house for the holidays. Weather-wise, this weekend in the Carolinas, pretty much a mess to even try to let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. But if you are bold enough to put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golf guy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.